ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
If you're one of those people who like to play video games, you have a lot of company. It's estimated that more than 150 million Americans are regular video game players. Worldwide, nearly 2 billion people make those games a part of their lives. How did it all start? Well, on this edition of UWM Today, we're going to look back at the history of video gaming. Michael Newman, an associate professor and the chair of UWM's Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies, has written a new book called Atari Age, a book that chronicles the way that our society has embraced electronic entertainment technology. And Michael is our guest on this edition of the program. Good to have you on board, Michael.
It's good to be here.
So, Atari Age, obviously, title comes from one of the companies that makes a lot of video games. How did you begin researching this to begin with?
Well, I'm a media scholar. I write about media and popular culture, and TV has been one of my interests. And when video games were new, people didn't really fully know what to make of them. And one way to think about them was as a way to kind of expand the potential of your television set. So I got into it by thinking about TV history and how there was a whole history of ways that people thought television could be improved, like the remote control, you wouldn't have to get out of your seat, or VCRs, you would be able to record a show to watch it later. Actually, video games, when they were new, were kind of like VCRs. They were this thing that would plug into the television set and expand its capability. You could make things happen on the TV set. You would be able to manipulate the image by using the controller to move something around or shoot something. That was really exciting. It seems like something anyone can do now with the devices that we carry around with us. But in the 70s, it was pretty novel and for a lot of people, revolutionary.
And it all did start in the early 70s. I saw somewhere that they believe the first video game was actually around 1971. Somebody said maybe late 60s there were people experimenting. But the big one, the place where we can maybe put down a marker was 1972, wasn't it? When the infamous game? Pong.
Pong came out in 1972, originally to play in public places, coin-operated, like a pinball machine, like a tavern. But in the same year, another video game, the Magnavox Odyssey, which was a console to plug into the TV set, also came out. And that's something that could be played in the home, and it allowed you to play a variety of games. But one of them was tennis, which was basically Pong. What we think of now as kind of primitive, very simplistic, abstract kind of games where you just pass a ball back and forth would have been a lot of people's first experience of these. There were some computer games that were programmed to play before that, like at MIT in the 1960s, hackers programmed a space war game. Most people had not had an experience of playing an electronic game, though, until the 70s.
You know, I didn't realize that Pong first showed up in the bars and not on the TV. I remember playing it as a much younger person back in the early 70s, and I thought it was made only for the TV screen. But it actually had its predecessor back in the arcade days, huh?
Yeah, and the story goes that it was so popular that it stopped working because the coin box had gotten stuffed full of quarters. So it was a big attraction in taverns, arcades, public places. You know, any place that you could see someone kill in 5 minutes, even like a bus depot or a bowling alley, they would put up these machines. And there had been arcade machines like pinball, but also, you know, shooter games, vending machines, jukeboxes. You know, places that you would see coin operated. Machines, basically.
So is the notion of the arcade being the grandfather or the predecessor of all of these TV video games, is that surprising to people? Or was this just a natural evolution of the way that maybe our folks used to go and spend their nickels and their dimes 50 years ago, right?
Sure, and these go back to the 19th century with penny arcades and dime museums before them. would have been places people might have gone for leisure time amusement. But yeah, the arcade was a fixture of resort areas or urban streets. People would be, you know, passing by when they're doing their shopping. So yeah, there's a whole history of this kind of amusement. This was very high tech in the 70s because it was electronic and used TV technology and then later on computer technology. There had been a kind of disreputable association people had with pinball, and so some of these games had been seen as the playthings of gamblers, or the mob could collect on them, that kind of thing. So maybe some people wouldn't see themselves as players of these coin-operated games, but they were very familiar.
Did anybody have a notion back then that electronic games would become as big as they have today?
Not really, not as big as this, as they became actually quite quickly. At first, I'm sure there were people who were hoping they would be a big hit, but in the later 1970s, Atari was acquired by Warner Communications, which is a big media conglomerate, and within a few years was earning more for that corporation than movies were earning. So it was a pretty rapid rise, and I'm not sure if anyone foresaw just how huge a business video games would be, but they have become an enormous component of the entertainment industry.
So what was the driving force? Was it the creative minds that were dreaming up the new video games, the one that would top last year's version? Or were it the engineers in the background that were imagining that they could outdo themselves in terms of the actual technology that was displaying the games?
Yeah, I'm sure it's a combination of those. For the people who were creating the games in the first place in the late 60s and early 70s, sometimes they were thinking in terms of giving people something to do with the television set other than watch broadcasts over the air. They saw a potential to use this technology in a way that hadn't been done before. They're certainly trying to create a commercial product and expand leisure time amusement into new areas, a new way of making money. But there's a huge creative component to this, and games keep developing over time and innovating in various ways to capture new consumers.
How about television manufacturers? How do they react to the notion of their set being commandeered for something that they probably didn't ever imagine possible when TV came out in the 50s?
Yeah. Well, actually, some of the manufacturers were in the television electronics business, like Magnavox or Fairchild, who came out with these. RCA came out with a model. Some of them were from toy companies like Mattel or Coleco. And, they're just creating a product that might sell. It's good for them if people want to use the TV for lots of different purposes. And they were also making hi-fi equipment and video equipment of other kinds. The TV networks had more to worry about, because if people started to watch television during the prime time hour after dinner and instead of watching the broadcast, that might have been threatening to them. And actually, I found in my research that in Advertising Age magazine in the later 70s, video games were paired with VCRs as a potential, quote, nightmare for the networks, unquote. So if you tape the show you want to watch and go out for dinner and then, watch it a week later, that's not good for the TV networks, because they have advertisers who hope that you'll be watching those commercials. And same story if you're going to be playing Atari in the evening instead of watching TV, then you're not watching commercials.
Is there a profile of the typical video player back then? I guess I'll ask the question two ways. Who first started really getting into these games when they began to become popular in the early 70s? And has that profile changed or evolved over the years?
Sure. Well, we do have a stereotype of the video game player often as male and young and maybe kind of lonely, pathetic, that kind of thing, which is a negative stereotype and not a truthful one, I don't think. It's really hard to say, because they're played by a lot of people. So when they were first marketed to consumers, they were sold as something for families to do together, as a leisure time amusement for the family to play as a way to enjoy each other's company, kind of like playing board games, playing ping pong in the basement or the rec room. And so a lot of the imagery that we find in advertisements or in packaging, basically in the pitch to consumers, is of a family circle together, where you see parents and children or players of different sexes or different ages enjoying each other's company, like a father and son or like a romantic couple maybe playing a Pong type of game. And actually, some of these are two-player games. You wouldn't play them alone. Over time, we know from some research that was done in the later 70s and early 80s, younger players and boys in particular started to claim more ownership of video games, and the industry recognized them to be a major driver of commerce in this area. So the arcade was particularly kind of masculine space. Maybe 80% or more of the players in arcades were young male players, teenagers, or young adults. In the home, it was a more balanced picture. Parents and children both played, but fathers probably played more than mothers. Girls and boys both played, but sometimes the boys might play for longer, or they'd be more likely to trade games with their friends or kind of claim ownership. And maybe after the parents lost to their children, they gave up, but the kids persisted.
I'm smiling because I remember when my parents first saw the early video games, they would walk by the TV and just shake their head. They didn't get it. They didn't get it at all. And I'm suspect today, if you had a young parent watching their kid get their first exposure, there might be a fight for who gets the control panel or not, right?
Perhaps. Well, you know, certainly parents who grew up playing the games would have a different attitude towards them. Or at least a different kind of perspective than adults 40 years ago for whom they were really unfamiliar. For some of them, they were very exciting and cool and they wanted to get an experience of it. And for some, they were probably just unfamiliar and strange and not all that interesting. So kind of hard to say. I do think that they've always been played by more than just one type of player, and that even if the industry focused on marketing more to young male players, which probably caused them to be seen more that way. They've been played by girls and women all along.
Let's talk about that, the gender mix. You said early on it was primarily boys. When did girls begin to spend more time playing the games than when they were first introduced?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to say. We're talking about a lot of people, and it was a while ago. I think that girls and women have always played, like I said, and the proprietors of arcades and the people who were operating as coin-operated business people, putting arcade machines in different locations, really wanted women to be playing because they saw that it would be a way of making their business more respectable. If it was all young male type players, then it was less likely to be seen as respectable than if it was balanced between men and women or boys and girls. So I don't really have a story to tell about when girls played more or less. I think they've played all along, but definitely in the 80s, the marketing message was very masculine. And Nintendo, for example, saw boys as their key market segment, and they named their handheld device the Game Boy, and I think that was no accident.
Yeah, I remember my son spending a lot of time in the back seat with that Game Boy. Was it Donkey Kong? I think was, I think I actually found one of the old games in the garage a year or two ago. In terms of the content of the video games, simple tabletop tennis competition early on, and then at some point sports began to populate the gaming world. In fact, I remember the Madden 2000, Madden 2015. I guess it's not Madden. Is it still Madden? I think it is. Yeah, even though he's retired and off the air, his name still is attached to it. Was sports a late arrival in terms of the content of these games, or was that always part of the genre?
Sports was always part of the genre. If you think about Pong, it actually is sports.
Yeah.
A lot of the early games were adaptations of baseball, football. Auto racing was a big one. There was a lot of driving games. Driving's always been big. I would say in the 1970s and early 80s, in the period that I'm talking about in my book, sports and science fiction and shooting account for a big part of what we're talking about. So space adventure, anything that goes zip and zap and blasts and makes explosion sounds, anything that's really active and aggressive and violent would also potentially be part of the story. Masculine genres, not just sports, but science fiction and action adventure and war. Often adapting from movies. Some of the big titles were actually based on movie scenarios like Space Invaders, which was was, you know, based on the War of the Worlds adaptation from the 1950s, the movie. So there's some variety, but there's also some redundancy. You know, a lot of the games were about firing at enemies and killing them.
And I'm thinking about our earlier discussion about the connection between the old-time arcades and video games. I remember playing pinball, and you know, you had every flavor of emotion that or conflict in a very static setting on the front of that pinball
machine. On the
back glass.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And on the the representations on those back glass were really colorful in the 1970s and varied. You know, sometimes kind of sexy, sometimes like science fiction movies. Sometimes picking up on the themes of popular entertainment of the time, like the pinball wizard character from the Who, Tommy recording and movie. There was a popular one called Wizard. And you know, pinball and video games go together. They were both popular at the same time. In the late 70s, there was a huge boom for pinball when the pinball machines became solid state instead of electromechanical. And it's really around the same time that electronic coin-operated TV games, video games, were occupying more space in the arcades.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us. And this week in the studio, Michael Newman. Michael is an associate professor and chair of UWM's Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies, and just came out with a new book called Atari Age, looking back at the history of video games and other electronic entertainment that occupies so darn much of our collective time. Michael, have you drawn any conclusions as a result of your research as to what impact playing these games have on us and society? Has it changed us at all?
Well, you know, the kind of research I do is cultural history, and I'm interested in how people thought about games at the time and what place they occupied in society at the time that I'm writing about, when they were new, but basically the first decade when we had video games in American society. So one of the things I write about is that they provoked strong reactions, that some people believed they were having powerful harmful effects. Some people believe that they had the potential to have really beneficial effects. And I don't really come down one way or the other and thinking, yes, they have harmful effects or they have beneficial influences or anything else. I'm more interested in thinking, why did people have so much investment in the idea that they were this powerful new thing that was going to have an impact on society? So it's, you know, it's probably some combination of the two, and not nearly as extreme as people feared or hoped at the time.
What were the negative effects that they feared?
Well, as with many new media, when they're just emerging and becoming really popular with young people in particular, there are a lot of fears about video games. There were fears that they might have a harmful physical effects, that they could be bad for your wrist. You know, there was this condition, Space Invaders Wrist, that a medical journal wrote about. And there have been a number of these sort of colorful conditions that are caused by these new technologies.
I wish I knew that. I could have told my mom, I can't cut the lawn.
My wrist
hurt. Yeah.
Or they might harm your eyesight, things like that. People worried that they'd be addictive. They were worried that children would do badly in school as a consequence. The arcades and other public places of amusement were feared as sites of teenage hangout kind of behaviors, loitering, making fast remarks at passersby, maybe drugs and sex and other illicit behavior. You know, some municipalities tried to regulate or even ban video arcades from their borders. So there was some freaking out. There were some, you know, very exercised authority figures from parent-teacher organizations, municipal government leaders, therapists, people like that, who were really concerned for the young people growing up with these newfangled things that could be bad for them.
But it looks like we've survived.
A generation grew up playing these games. I mean, I guess some kids did badly in school as a consequence, and maybe still do. It's not that they're, you know, completely without the potential for you know, being overused or anything else. But there was just a kind of exercised response, maybe out of proportion to what place they actually had in people's lives.
What about the possible positive effects? Why did people think that this actually might be a good thing when they first came out?
Well, to answer that, it's good to think about what's going on in the early 80s when this panic and frenzy, but also optimism, is going on. And a lot of observers had seen shifts in the American economy and American society towards a world in which people work more in offices than in factories. You know, people called it the post-industrial society, and computers were coming along right at this time. You know, Time magazine named the computer its machine of the year around this time, instead of a man or a person of the year. So computers are new, and they're definitely going to be part of this new technological society of work in offices, this post-industrial service and knowledge economy. And so many young people were gaining a first experience of computers through video games. A lot of families bought home computers, not knowing quite what they would do in the home with a computer, because you know, most people hadn't ever used one. Actually, one of the reasons people gave for owning a computer was to learn how to use a computer. You know, self-reflexive kind of purpose.
If it's there, it'll become part of me, right?
But the software that you could get easily and use without much training would be games. You could play games on home computers. So a lot of children played games on home computers, maybe learned to program them, so that would be a way of learning to use this new important technology. But also were being exposed to a tool that would probably be useful to them in education and in the workplace in the future. So people saw video games as this futuristic, new age kind of tool. That were definitely helping children learn. They were learning how to play the games. They were probably learning how to use some new technology they were unfamiliar with. And that might help them be better workers in the future, get a better job. You know, some kids programmed games and sold them. They were becoming entrepreneurial. You know, there's a story on the news, on NBC News in the early 80s about a kid whose parents forbade him from having a computer at home. So he saved up his money and bought one himself, programmed a game, sold it for $60,000. And then his parents called him, Tommy McMillions instead of Tommy McWilliams. There was this sort of potential for video games to promise all kinds of benefits, just at the same time that people were worried they were going to ruin your eyesight and make you drop out of school and become a drug addict and lead you down the wrong path.
So you wrote about the beginning and the early part of the industry. Are we still in the age of Atari, as your book is titled?
In some ways, yes, but Atari hasn't been the most popular form of video games since the period that I'm describing, pretty much. By the later 1980s, Nintendo had replaced Atari. And the brand Atari exists, and a lot of people still play those games, but it's a retro gaming, nostalgia kind of phenomenon at this point. So the typical games that people play now are so much different from Atari games. They look different, they sound different, they're in some ways more sophisticated, and technologically they're completely different. And there are games that take hours and hours and hours of your time that lead you through a kind of a narrative that's so different from the typical experience of a game in the 70s or in the early 80s.
Well, and one of the other big developments is now, thanks to high-speed internet, not only can you be playing your video game sitting comfortable in your shorts and t-shirt in your living room, but you could be playing against someone who's in their shorts and t-shirt on the other side of the world, these online games.
That's right, which are really exciting and show how social video gaming can be. You know, the stereotype of the solitary gamer is really different from the experience of online play, where you're talking to all these other people or typing to them and playing with them or against them. And I think it's a good reminder that these forms of play are social. And actually, they were social in the period that I'm talking about, too. People went to the arcade to watch each other play, to get tips from each other, to compete to set the high score. Kids played with their friends in their rec rooms and basements and bedrooms.
We sometimes hear criticism that young people spend too much time with that hand console in their hands, that they should be out on the playground or out on their bikes. Any evidence that we are less physically healthy because of the engagement with these video games?
I don't know. Video games alone are not going to be the culprit for that, because there's a lot of sedentary and solitary and not all that physically active things that we do. I'm not sure what to say about that. Reading a book isn't really getting you out either, but we don't complain about kids sitting around reading books all the time.
What about the violence in video games? You mentioned the concern that early on that this might be changing the behavior or shaping the behavior or actions of young people. Has that always been a constant concern?
And it was a big concern in the period that I'm writing, that I wrote about in my book. TV at that time was blamed for a lot of social problems. and had a pretty low reputation. People in the 70s wrote books about TV with titles like The Plug-In Drug and the Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. So TV was seen as addictive and definitely causing violence and aggression in many people's opinions. And so when video games come along and are basically a television technology, you play using a television set that were replacing television in people's time, a lot of observers saw similar phenomena occurring with games leading to aggression or violence. And actually, people said, you know, when you watch TV, you just see someone commit violence. But when you play a video game, you commit the violence. You know, you are the Pac-Man, or you are the one shooting the space invaders. You know, you're kind of taking the role of whatever's on the screen. So there was a ton of concern about this, and that concern kind of hasn't gone away. I think a lot of people still are concerned about young people in particular playing violent games. But then, as you say, a lot of kids have grown up playing these games and seem to be okay. And
society
and
goes on.
Yeah, I would also say that they're just new technologies for doing old things. You know, kids have been playing with sticks that they turn into swords or guns, and chasing each other around and waging war in the backyard or in the street.
And there's always been an adult to stand behind them and tisk, tisk, tisk,
scolding,
and say, when I was young, it was all different, right?
That's right.
Michael, just a minute left. As you look forward, where is your research going to take you? What's on the horizon for you?
Wow. To tell you the truth, I'm not even sure. I have a variety of projects that I work on. I might continue to write about video games, but I'm a media scholar, and I've written before about television and new media. And, I might write about something contemporary after having written something historical. I wrote this partly because I wanted to write about a historical topic that would let me read old magazines and revisit old times. And I might be happy now to write about something contemporary.
Well, we wish you very best of luck as you continue your journey of looking at us and society using that wonderful set of mediums that surround us all. So we need people like you to look back and help us understand what the heck has gone on before us and what might be ahead of us as a result of our habits. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Mike Newman, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. You might pick up his book, by the way, The Atari Age, which came out recently. I think you'll enjoy the read. Well, that's all for this week's program. Thanks for being with us this week as we hear about the great people at UWM. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.